Today's episode is sponsored by Lake Pajamas. There's no better feeling than putting on a pair of pajamas at the end of the day, and Lake designs the softest pajamas imaginable. You'll reach for them every night. Lake creates silhouettes and fabrics for every sleep and lounge preference, from their signature 100% Peruvian Pima cotton pajama sets to their buttery soft dream knit to crisp and breathable cotton poplin. In Lake's newest collaboration, they partnered with fellow female founder Blair Eady of Atlantic Pacific to create vivid pieces brimming with confidence and femininity. Launching March 22nd, this limited edition collaboration is a rainbow of sun-soaked sleepwear in their signature Pima, plus ready-to-wear dresses and select styles that double as a cover-up, packing in a poolside punch. Take it from Blair Eady, great personal style never sleeps. Text Second Life to 21426 to subscribe to Lake's texts and to be able to shop the collab a day early on March 21st. Again, that's Second Life to number 21426. Plus, receive 10% off towards your Atlantic Pacific for Lake purchase with the code Second Life. Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I'm speaking with the founder of Atlantic Pacific, Blair Eady. Debuting 13 years ago as one of the original fashion blogs, Atlantic Pacific has since grown into a multi-tiered digital fashion and style brand, fueled by original content and a growing online community of women, including almost 2 million Instagram followers. Blair creates digital campaigns, provides creative direction, and develops co-branded product collaborations for many global brands, including Nordstrom, Saks Fifth Avenue, J. Crew, Kate Spade, and many, many more. Most recently, she's collaborated on a 16-piece capsule collection with Lake Pajamas, and it's truly, truly phenomenal. But back when Blair initially launched Atlantic Pacific, she was actually working in the corporate retail world, first for Gap Inc. in San Francisco, and then for Tory Burch in New York City, where she eventually ran accessories merchandising for the entire company. It's quite the journey to where she is today, through many sides of the fashion industry, and she's here to talk about it all. Now, on Second Life, it's Blair Eady. Okay, are you feeling ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, good. Blair, on this podcast, we like to start at the beginning. So, what did you study in school? And much more importantly, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I studied political science in school with a minor in business, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I'm very envious of those who have a clear picture as to where they want to go in life, but I was definitely not one of those people.
It's interesting because I've sat down with, now at this point, hundreds of women for this podcast, and it's a very even split of like folks who knew and then folks were like, I was just trying to figure things out. And
yeah.
It's comforting in an interesting way because it makes me feel like your path is your path. No matter where you start, you'll figure it out eventually. So speaking of figuring it out eventually, tell me about your first post-school job.
Yes. So as I said, I was remarkably unbothered at the age of 21 with no idea what I wanted to do. And I was interviewing for jobs that were all over the map. But I'm originally from the Washington, D.C. area, a lot of government jobs there. So most of my interviews were actually in more like government contracting jobs.
Really?
Yeah, I know. And I had a friend who had applied to the Gap Retail Management Program, which is an executive training program. And I decided that I would apply to that because I was interested in it. Obviously, had no background in fashion, but the program did take on just like a plethora of different people with different backgrounds. So I decided to apply, but that was the only fashion job I applied to, which is just funny now looking back how ingrained I've become in the fashion world. But at that time, that was like my one foot in the door.
So I've heard about this program from folks over the years, but I don't actually really understand it or know that many details. All I know, it's like cool and desirable. But I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about what your work is like, especially in that first year.
Yeah. So one of the things I was really drawn to in the program is that this was really a training program where if you didn't study fashion, it was like a crash course in everything that you need to know in financial planning and inventory management, product development and production, and then merchandising and design. So it was a 12-month program, and it was split out into three segments. And in each segment, you learned these different skills. And it really was like remarkable. It was all hands-on learning, but then was like clearly like a paid salary job. I had 14 other people in my quote-unquote class. So you also got to go on this journey with other people who were going through similar things. But it was an amazing, amazing program. So I felt like it was almost like a year of college after college. And then after the program, you were graded on every different function. And then you essentially requested certain positions. And then they would match you based on how well you exceeded in each role and like the fit that they were looking for. So it was really a wonderful year of learning. And I think it was nice to go through a program that 1 year post grad with other people who are kind of in the same boat. And it felt a little bit more like a stepping stone into the real world versus getting thrown into corporate America, like right off the bat.
That's amazing. Okay, so was this based in San Francisco, in HQ, or in New York?
Yes. So most of Gap Inc.'s corporate headquarters are in San Francisco. So I was out in San Francisco. In my interview for them was also in San Francisco, which was the first time I'd ever been to California. Aww. I moved out there not knowing anybody, which was another part of like the whole journey of obviously finding yourself after college. And so, yeah, I moved out to California, packed up my bag, moved into a studio, and started my fashion career.
I love the fact that it sort of blends like the vibe of an MBA and then sort of like the residency matching part of medical school, but just in this fashion world and only for a year. That feels like such a remarkable opportunity. And I'm curious, as you were going through it, was it clear to you what pieces really appealed to you? Is it the situation where you're like, I was really good at this aspect, but I hated it. And I really loved this other part, but that didn't come as naturally. What was that time like?
Yes. So immediately I did fall in love with merchandising, which many people do because you can kind of think of merchandising as the hub of the wheel when you're in a fashion production cycle. So merchandising really touches on every single part of the production lifecycle for fashion. So you're working one-on-one with the design team, the product development team, the financial planning team, even like the store ops team. And you're equally responsible for the aesthetic outcome of the line, making sure you're creating something that's beautiful, on trend, connects with the consumer. But then at the same time, you're also responsible for the financial success of it. So it's where art meets science and fashion. So merchandising was definitely what I was drawn to. The catch is there has to be an open role. And so there were very few merchandising roles open, but I really knew that that's the path I wanted to take. And there were other jobs within inventory management and product development in, let's say, sexier categories, but the only opening was in men's basic socks and underwear. And so that was my first merchandising job, which was very interesting, just like a very basics driven category, clearly something I don't wear. And so it was very, very funny. But quickly thereafter, I moved on to women's dresses and outerwear, which are two incredibly fun categories. But I think like looking back on my career, I knew I really wanted to do merchandising, and I knew my first job wasn't going to be my job forever. And this was like the easiest path to continue to grow my merchandising career. I always talk about this with like some friends where they're like, oh, I don't know, I'm interested in this job, but it's not perfect. And I'm like, we all have to have like our men's basic socks and underwear moment and then know that like eventually you will end up, you know, where you're meant to be. But it's all about like at each step in your career, like what are you adding to your toolbox to get you to the end goal of where you ultimately want to be? Because at 23, you have to be realistic and realize like your first job is not going to be your dream job. So while men's basic socks and underwear was wonderful and I learned a ton, definitely not where my passion lies.
So what was the day-to-day like in that role? Because I understand all of the words that you're saying, but I still don't have like a clear picture of it because it is so far removed from my side of the industry that I've always been on. So I'm so curious, like, what does your day-to-day look like?
Merchandising, because it does follow the product life cycle. And at the time I was working at Old Navy and we did monthly drops. So every single week it was different. And so, for example, you might be 1 week working on the line plan to determine what you want to develop and produce 16 months from now. Or you could be sitting in a product development meeting where you're seeing second protos of something that's going to come out in just a few months. So every single day was different and all of the calendars overlapped. So you also had to multitask really well to say, okay, the first half of my day, we're going to be focused on finishing development for holiday 23, but then we're also going to be in season hindsighting, you know, Q4 of 2022, as well as writing the line plan for spring 2024. So it was like a lot of juggling, but very fun, like incredibly dynamic, very, very interesting.
That also sounds like a lot of math.
Yes. And I think that's one of the misconceptions about working in fashion, especially the companies that I worked at, which were large, they were driving a lot of business, they were looking for growth, they were entering new categories. There is a lot of business. And I think some people love that, some people don't. I actually loved that aspect of it. I think, again, I love where the art meets the science. So I'm equally interested in like trend-wise, what's going on, what are incredible new innovations in fabric R&D, you know, what's happening on the runways, but then also digging into the financials and the numbers, as well as working with like really incredibly bright people to talk about industry strategy, like go forward and growth within like different channels, such as like online.
This is so fascinating because I am right now also like putting it together in a whole new way about how all of these skills that you're learning would have such incredible impact on your career as you move forward and pivoted, because the art and science of it all is what everyone has to do if they are a business owner. There's no version of, I'm just going to create something and like never look at the metrics on it. Okay, so you moved over to the women's side pretty quickly, you said, and then we're working on dresses. Did that feel like a more exciting fit, or was it the idea of like, I'm just applying the skills in this way? And were there any differences? Because I would imagine that it's a much bigger category, but I don't know what men's socks and undies are doing these days.
You would be surprised at the size of the business, especially being at a large, large retailer like Gap. But yes, women's dresses and outerwear was definitely a bigger category, as well as a category people naturally had more interest in within the company. So more opinions. I felt like when I was doing men's basic socks and underwear, you were the last category to ever present at any large meeting, like in front of the CEO and blah, blah, blah. So I think I only got to present like twice in front of the CEO in like my year and a half there, because everybody was like, burp, 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 we're out of time. Sorry, Blair. Like, but then with women's dresses and outerwear, it was much more about building the skills of like presentation and like really being more visible. And so I'm kind of glad that I got like my first experience in a category that maybe people didn't have as much interest in, because I feel like I could definitely make a lot more mistakes and people wouldn't notice. Whereas when I moved into dresses and outerwear, you know, you definitely felt like you were more under a microscope. So that was like a huge difference moving into that. But ultimately, I knew I wanted to work in women's. So that was like my stepping stone at that point in my career. It was like the first one was like, okay, get into merchandising. The second one was like, great, like let's get into women's. And I always knew after moving into women's, living in San Francisco was wonderful, but I'm an East Coast gal and San Francisco doesn't have as many fashion companies. And so I knew I wanted to move to New York, continue to work in women's. And so having worked at what would be considered a vertical company, we don't wholesale, it's very kind of insular, like how the whole process works, I knew I wanted to move into a larger company that was not vertical and was also international. So I could learn like a lot more about like the international business. So when the opportunity came up with Tory, it was like the perfect fit, because obviously I loved the brand, but in addition, it offered me these other things that I could learn.
And before we get into that, though, something happened along the way, which is you started Atlantic Pacific during this time, right?
I did, yes. I started Atlantic Pacific in 2010. So that was at the time I was working at Old Navy. At that point, I believe I had moved into women's dresses and outerwear. I used to take my pictures on the top of the parking garage at lunch. Aww. And I started it because when we were looking at trends, there was this huge shift, and we still used magazines, we still used editorials, we still used the runway. But then in addition, that's when street style blogs, and that's when Chictopia and Lookbook New became big. Who What Wear was obviously a massive point of inspiration for where we were going to go with trends. And so I recognized that there was like this new crop of people who were dictating what billion-dollar companies were putting out into the world based on what they thought was cool. And having known that I like was working at Old Navy, again, a wonderful company, but probably wouldn't have the same fashion influence as coming from, say, like a luxury brand, I wanted to essentially create a portfolio to say, I'm interested in fashion, obviously, outside of like a big box retailer, and I'm paying attention to trends. And so that's really why I started it initially. But it was so fun to become a part of the community, like from the very beginning when it was tiny, 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 as you know,
yep.
And to really like grow with the industry and see all of the changes happening.
And I think one of the parts that was so nice, because, you know, Who What Wear started in 2006. So in that same era, to your point, a little bit like men's basics, you could make mistakes, you could try things, you could figure stuff out. There wasn't so much of a spotlight. It's not like it is now. And there was this sense of community because, let's be honest, the digital world, even though it was leading in lots of things, was also kind of looked down upon, certainly by lots of aspects of the fashion industry. Meanwhile, I'm like, this is amazing. We need to spotlight Blair. I remember we did a story on you, and one of my best friends who was working for Bulgari at the time said, she owns a lot of Zara. I own a lot of the same pieces from Zara, but why is it so cool the way that she wears it? What is she doing that's making it look so much cooler? I have that same piece. And I was like, that's the magic of all of this. And, you know, getting to see that very specific point of view, not to mention as you're going through all this, like, I'm sure you're figuring out like what works from a photography standpoint, from a styling point of view. What were some of those biggest learnings for you in the early days of Atlantic Pacific?
Yeah. So in the early days, especially when I started in 2010, like it wasn't a business. I didn't even set out for it to be a business or become monetized. And even like the analytics we had were very, very minimal. So I do think in a very cool way for the first like year, year and a half, it was really about a passion for like sharing what we loved. And I think that's what I really love about a lot of like the blogs and sites and people who began sharing in that era, because people really were just doing it because they absolutely love to share. Whereas nowadays, not that there's anything wrong with it, but people begin their online careers with a PR team and a huge strategy and like with this long-term plan. And I look back and I'm like, wow, I was just a girl with a point and shoot camera who thought people really needed to see how I styled that Zara blazer. And it was so fun. And I think for me, it was more about growing my community. That necessarily didn't even mean like clicks or numbers, but it was like back in the day, like on blogs, people could like follow you on Blogspot. And it was like that whole idea of like, wow, like 100 more people followed me. That's so fun. Like these people actually really want to see my outfits. And so I think it really wasn't until 2011 when Reward Style started.
Mm-hmm.
They approached me and they were like, we'd really like you to put these affiliate links on your site and then you get a cut and like this and that. And I remember I was at work, I took like a 30-minute phone call in the middle of the day and I was like, this just seems incredibly strange. Like, I think people come to my site, but I don't think anybody buys anything. And they were like, I think you'd be surprised. And I remember I did it for like one weekend and I was like, wow, people really are buying these things. And I think that was kind of the moment where things started to change. And right around that time, brands started to recognize the value of influencers. And that's when these campaigns kind of started, mostly just like gifting campaigns, but still something. And that was the beginning of, wow, this could become like actually a business. So then I think from that inflection point, I did get a little bit more serious about following, you know, my numbers. How am I growing? How am I reaching people? And then that was right around the same time that Instagram started, which obviously changed the game in a big way.
Do you remember, aside from seeing the metrics on, oh, folks are actually buying from these links, or, oh, this following is starting to grow on Blogspot or on social media, do you remember any of those like early internal success markers for you where you started to feel like, I do have a point of view, people are interested, and this is really becoming kind of a thing?
Yeah. And I'm not doing this just to suck up to you, but I do have to say, like, Who What Wear, you guys did a post every single day. And like, when we got into the office, it was like the first thing that we all checked. And like, you'd see everybody's computers because we had like open seating. And so when you did the first full style profile on me, you would have thought I won the lottery. Like, there were people like screaming down the hallways being like, oh my gosh, like, we have to go out to lunch. Like, this is so exciting. And I think in a weird way, to your point, because some people did not necessarily see the value in what some early bloggers and street style photographers were doing. For me in the beginning, I think getting recognition from sites or from people that I felt like were more of like an industry standard of like, wow, they really do know fashion. So if they think that I'm doing something right, that is like a huge pat on the back for me. So I remember in the beginning, like that first style profile, I was like, this is like the highlight of my life. It was amazing. And so I feel like that was like one of like the big moments for me.
I remember that story so vividly because so many of my friends in the fashion community were like, this girl's really cool. Like, I love her style. You just felt like you were also doing something a little bit different and a little bit more optimistic and a little bit more timeless too, while still having that trend element, because this is kind of like the beginning era of model off duty. And there was a lot of indie sleaze going on in the background of things. And then you had a unique point of view.
Totally. It was like the time when like minimalism was like on the rise, and like even that Phoebe Philo, like Celine era. And I felt like I was like clown car fashion, but make it femme. I remember sticking to that though and saying like, well, this is kind of what I do, so I don't want to follow every trend. But mm-hmm. to your point, it is hilarious to look back at really what was happening in the industry from like a true high-end luxury fashion standpoint. And then me being on the other end being like, but do you like this? There's 10 colors in my outfit and I'm wearing 3 skirts on top of each other. Like, isn't this chic?
But I love that because, again, that kind of goes back to the idea of you weren't chasing trend. It was trend informed, certainly in different ways. But I really am always drawn to people who have a more clear point of view that isn't necessarily as wildly devoted to chasing the trend.
I love that.
So all of this is going on, which, how are you balancing that, by the way? Because were you starting to like batch content, or were you still doing it like on a day-to-day basis? What was your cadence like, and how did that fit with your work? And did anyone care that you had like a full separate self-made job?
I look back and I am thankful that I started when I was 25 and still eager and apparently didn't need a lot of sleep. I'm even tired thinking about like just how much I used to work, because I'd do like my day job and then I would go home and I would edit photos and I would get it up. And it's back in the day when you do a lot of like interviews on other people's blogs, I'd stay up super late doing those. So it was definitely hard to balance it all, but I think I loved both jobs so much and they were fulfilling in totally different ways. So my goal was always to continue to grow Atlantic Pacific while I grew my merchandising career until it just like wasn't feasible. So I kind of stuck on that path. And there were times where it ebbed and flowed where I really couldn't spend as much time on Atlantic Pacific. But for the most part, I really tried to do both. And I do have to say that I was very lucky in my career that at Gap Inc., I'm like one of these people who's like always scared of getting in trouble. So I told them, I was like, I'm starting this blog spot and I'm going to share these pictures. And I think HR was like, I'm sorry, what are you doing here? And I was like, I just like wanted to let you know. And they were like, okay, thank you. I do have to say that when I moved to New York in 2012, it was becoming much more of an industry. It was fascinating to interview and see. There were other companies that were not so cool with it. And then there were some that were like, absolutely, like, we totally understand that. So that was interesting going through that process and kind of seeing that. And again, luckily, the Tory Burch brand was incredible. And like, not only did they allow me to do it, but they like really championed me and they were really big supporters, which is wonderful.
That's amazing. So tell me about that transition. So after about 4 years, you decide to start looking for your next gig. Did you have a job before you moved? Did you decide to move and then look for a job? What was that process like?
Yes. So I had been dating my now husband, Andrew, for about 5 years at that point. We both worked in the industry. He was working at Levi's corporate. We both are East Coasters. We both wanted to move to New York. So he was focused more on menswear jobs, which there's just not as many in the industry. And because I was making money on Atlantic Pacific, I said, why don't you look for a job first? And then once you get a job, we'll move. And then I will then look for a job once we're there. And so 1 week before I was moving, because I don't talk a lot about my personal life on the site, I didn't tell anybody I was moving. I could only give my company 2 weeks notice based on Andrew's new job. So I get an email from the Tory Burch team asking me if I would like to host a store event in Maiden Lane in San Francisco. And I was like, oh, funny story. I'm actually not going to be here in 2 weeks. I'm moving. And they're like, where are you moving? And I was like, I'm moving to New York. And they were like, do you have a job? And I was like, I don't. Like, my husband got a job. We're going to move, but I intend on working. So I'm going to look once I get there. And they were like, you should work here. Funnily enough, Tory Burch was growing their merchandising team and really building out more of an infrastructure around that. So I went in and somebody happened to be going on maternity leave. This was like 1 day after we moved to New York. So I started at Tory in ready to wear. Clearly, it was a consulting position because I was just filling in for somebody. But luckily, they were building out also the accessories side of the business, which to me actually was more interesting because I had been focused on ready to wear at Gap Inc. And that's like the lion's share of their business. So at Tory, it was so great because like accessories obviously are the lion's share of their business. It's the opposite. And I was so excited because I was like, I've never done accessories before. It'd be such a great opportunity to learn them at Tory. And a position opened. And so I moved over into the accessories team, which was just such a nice fit.
So from your perspective, yes, it's a new skill set, but did it feel like a big stretch? Or did you feel like I'm applying the same skills to the slightly different category? It doesn't require like a full update to my skill set. It's just additive. I'm interested in your perspective on that.
So there were certain aspects of the job when it came more to the business acumen, calendarizing, creating process side, I actually felt like I could add a ton because again, Tory was like, I mean, they grew in leaps and bounds and they were still trying to figure out at that time within merchandising how to structure the teams, which milestone meetings they wanted to put on the calendar. So I felt like coming from like a well-oiled machine, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I can definitely be helpful in that. But then to your point, when we hopped over to the product side, I definitely lost a lot of my like confidence, you know, that I had had being a product merchant at Gap Inc. only from the standpoint that like I didn't know all the terminology and I didn't know as much about the leathers and textiles. And so I think sometimes that can knock you down a bit and make you feel lesser than. But I do have to say there were so many people there who were incredibly, incredibly collaborative. And I think I've been very lucky in my career that I have worked at companies that I feel like operate from a place of kindness. And Tory very much is like that. So people helped me along the way, but it was a huge learning curve on the product side. And when you think about it, that's being a merchant and wanting to deliver a beautiful line and working with this new design team, it was definitely hard in the beginning that I felt a little bit timid. And I feel like I'd never been that way in my career before. So that was definitely the learning curve for me.
Because at that point, you were a known person, certainly within the industry, did you feel like that pressure or nerves was in part because you were more visible outside of work?
Yeah, there were like a couple things going on. And I can't decide if like this was the reality or if this was inside my head, but there were two things going on. One, to your point, feeling like, wow, does everybody just think I got this job because I'm an influencer? And I'm not actually qualified to be here. And that like plays into the whole thing of like, oh, I don't know the name of that hardware. Like they are going to think that I'm like a fraud. And then there was also this other aspect of like moving to New York for the first time, working in a much more high-end company with people who have come from a lot of luxury houses all over the world. And then, you know, I came from Old Navy, which is a wonderful company and is incredible for a foundation of learning. But again, I think I always just wondered in the back of my mind if I was being judged because, you know, I didn't come from Loewe. A couple years ago, I was doing men's basic socks and underwear. I think that those things definitely like lingered in the back of my head. And nobody necessarily treated me that way, but there was was always that like fear in me that like those were the things that people were thinking.
So how long did it take for you to overcome that imposter syndrome? And what do you think turned that key for you where you felt like, yeah, I got this and I feel comfortable here and I know what I'm doing and let's go?
To be honest, it probably took like a full 6 months. And I think one thing I really dedicated myself to is reaching out and forming relationships with cross-functional partners, peers, as well as people who weren't necessarily at my level, higher, lower. And then that way I could form more of like a community, if you will, like within the company. And if I needed help, I could ask for help and I could just be really transparent that I didn't know something. There are several people along the way who didn't necessarily work in merchandising who really helped like guide me in those first few months. And that helped me. And I think like looking back, that is why I feel as though I always try to create a very like team and collaborative environment because we spend so much time at work. Like, why can't we all just make it easier on each other? I think that really helped me.
That makes sense. I always say that it takes 6 months to a year of a new job before you start to feel comfortable in it, no matter how prepared you are. The culture is different. The responsibilities are different. It just takes a minute to adjust. So that all makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm also curious about, were you managing at this point? And had you been? And how did that piece of it sort of fit within your skill set?
So I did have one direct report right before I left Old Navy, which was great. So at least I had like a little bit of experience, but clearly not a ton. And then when I moved over to the consulting role, it was kind of interesting because they knew I wasn't going to be permanent. So I always kind of felt like I was just like floating around. And finally, when I moved into the accessories role and we were really building out the team, that is where I started to get like that management experience. We were hiring as well as there were already people in place who were beginning to report to me. And that is definitely a huge learning curve, like in anybody's career. So I think in the beginning, it was hard because Tory is a wonderful company. A lot of people stay for a very long time. And there were some people who had been at the company for a really long time and felt as though I shouldn't be at the level that I'm at, or maybe these people shouldn't be reporting. But as the company grew and we were bringing in new people, I think it really helped to create an environment where it wasn't just like, oh, I'm the new kid and I need to constantly be proving myself. And we had a huge hiring spree in merchandising, which was awesome because I think it also helped just to shake things up a bit and have outside perspectives from people who had come from other brands and people who had even come from other functions. So I feel like at that turning point, managing people is always difficult, but hiring people from outside the company, I think, created a much better team environment where it wasn't like everybody's been here for 8 years and knows exactly what's going on.
So I'm interested in what kinds of things were going on behind the scenes for Atlantic Pacific and your work there, and what was exciting and what was overwhelming, because as someone who lived in New York, it's just a pressure cooker in so many ways, so much opportunity, but also that can be distracting, that can be overwhelming. So how were you trying to navigate through all of it? And at what point were you starting to think like, maybe this is the future, is to go out on my own?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. When I moved there, I wanted to move obviously for a merchandising career opportunity where I could continue to grow that career. But I didn't anticipate that now I'm actually in the same city as a lot of my clients and these events I could never go to. And I think that first 2 years, I was so exhausted because you do feel like you don't want to miss out. And so you do say yes to everything. And then in addition, living on the West Coast, but being from the East Coast, from a personal standpoint, nobody ever visited me in San Francisco, but everybody was always in New York. And so it was just like every single person from my life were like, I'm in New York this weekend. I'm like, this is a lot to handle. It was amazing in so many ways that I got to personally make connections with a lot of people that I had started to work with Atlantic Pacific. But I did have to start to draw a lot of boundaries because I just got so burnt out. And this is also around the time in the influencer industry, if you remember, it's like 2013, 2014, when it was like, in order to be relevant, you have to be in like a different country every week. It was like that whole travel element of the influencer world. Mm-hmm. And I remember so many of the opportunities ended up also including travel as well as like events. And I was like, I can't do these things. And so that did force my hand to say no to quite a few things and be much more picky about my time. But it was very overwhelming.
I'm also curious about the monetization piece of it. So you spoke earlier about the affiliate piece of it, which, by the way, like I remember when there was a big article that came out and it was like Pink Peonies was making $1 million in commission a year herself. And people were like, blew their heads off. So it's a very lucrative part of the business, but that's only one part of the business. There's also partnerships and branded content and all of that. So at what point were you doing some of these like larger partnerships and how were you thinking that through?
Yes, exactly. So I kind of look at my business in three buckets. So affiliate, partnerships, and then rev share. And when I say rev share, that means typically collaborating on a product line and receiving like a licensing fee or like a rev share of the product. And at the time, most of my business in 2012, 2013, it was mostly affiliate and then partnerships. But what was interesting is that that was right around the time that the business did start to expand where brands recognized, oh my gosh, like if these people are driving this many sales to our site, what would that look like if we actually put their name on the product? I imagine that would give it like a 2x times build. And so those opportunities started to arise, the first one being a co-branded nail polish line at Sephora. And that's a little bit more tricky because, again, I wanted to be really respectful for my position at Tory. And that is when I would have to go to them and be like, hey, listen, like, this is a really amazing opportunity, but like, I would be putting my name on something. And I think I also wanted to be really respectful that there were some opportunities at the time where I didn't want people on my team or peers within the company to think that I wasn't taking my job at Tory seriously. And I think that was like a hard balance.
Yeah.
And there were certain times where I was granted opportunities to go and attend an event or an activation that was travel and I would miss a meeting. But if you think about it, it wasn't like people like didn't know where I was because I'm online posting about it. So I also felt like I had to be like really transparent with my team. Like, listen, this was approved, but I'm going here. And it became a tricky balance. And that was kind of around the time that I was like, wow, between like co-branded lines and then a lot of activations and whatnot, more focused around travel, I just started to recognize like, I really need to pick a lane and I'm really getting burnt out and I really need to make sure that I'm giving my team and everybody at Tory 100%. And I was, but I was also just always worried that that wasn't the perception. But definitely over the years, like affiliate has always remained incredibly strong and is such a great revenue stream. But then also it's the partnerships. And I've been really lucky in the sense that I've had a lot of like long-term partners, people that I've worked with for almost 10 years now. And I think that makes what I do so much easier because if I were having to deal with new clients every single week, it's exhausting. And I think it's so nice that these people have essentially become like my coworkers. It's the people I've worked with for years. And then again, obviously Sephora became the first co-branded collaboration that I did. And then I moved into Nordstrom and then Lily Sedui and then Pamela Munson and then launching Lake this year. So those partnerships have become much, much bigger part of the whole industry.
So I want to get into all of that, but I want to first talk a little bit about the Sephora situation. What was that like for you? How did it come to you? What did it mean for you? And what were your learnings from it?
Yeah, so I was directly contacted by the Sephora team. Not that it's bad to work through an agency, but it's always just really nice to work like directly with a brand. I also don't have an agent and have never had an agent. But that can be a little bit scary because I'm always having to like double check my own work and make sure that I am not getting taken advantage of. And unlike an agency where they have kind of like a macro view of like what's going on in the industry and like what a fair contract is, like I kind of have to figure that out on my own. And I don't mind doing that. But I think Sephora was a little surprised when they were like, if you can just give us your agent's contact. And I'd be like, oh, that would be me. And so, yeah, Sephora came to me and I remember thinking this was a really perfect first collaboration in the sense that I obviously love nail polish. I love color. It's a good brand fit. I really like their team. But then in addition, I feel like it was something that was not as complicated as, say, a Nordstrom building an 150 SKU line. And so, again, I think that this was like a good opportunity for me to like learn about how these go, what to look out for next time. And luckily, like, the collaboration was incredibly smooth sailing. And again, they were wonderful to work with. And I think that's the first time that it clicked for me. This is something that I enjoy doing. Of course, I enjoy working on product. So I think in the past, I'd been a little bit more hesitant about these types of branded collaborations. I think that really opened the door to, like, the possibilities of me being just more open to the idea of doing more of these.
So to fast forward a couple of years, it's now 2016. You're 6 years in. You make the decision to quit Tory Burch. Tell me about coming to that tipping point and what happened next.
Yes. So loved working at Team Tory, loved my job. Very, very hard to make that decision. But I had gotten to a point where Atlantic Pacific had become so big and robust, and Tory continued to grow and have tremendous success, and the teams continued to grow. And I just recognized, I was like, I'm only one person. I cannot do both of these well. I really need to pick a lane. And my thought process in that decision making was that I think the influencer industry is around to stay. So I'm not saying that the industry is fleeting, but I felt like my time in the industry is more fleeting on the influencer side than on the merchandising side, because merchandising will always exist in the industry. Whereas, like, being an influencer, it can be fickle, right? And I think that there's so many changes going on, and it was kind of like strike while the iron's hot. And so I was like, you know what, I'm gonna take the leap. I'm gonna go over, I'm gonna do Atlantic Pacific full time. And if it doesn't work out, I feel like I will always have a place to go back to, because I'm also not moving into a career path that has absolutely nothing to do with merchandising and fashion. I'm still gaining a ton of knowledge. So I decided end of 2016, I stopped working at Tory full time. I still worked part time because they were like, can you just, like, come in a few days a week? Through the beginning of 2017. That was a really, really hard decision to make, because to be completely honest, I am not the type of entrepreneur who bashes corporate America and is like, I could never go back. There's, like, some days where I'm like, man, I really miss being in an office with, like, other people. And I think it's just different. It's whatever draws you. But I feel like for me, I love being an entrepreneur, but I also equally love being a small part of something much bigger than myself. So I definitely miss that on days. And I almost feel like I could have lived two different lives if that would have been allowed.
I understand that more than you would imagine. So we touched on it briefly earlier, but let's talk about the incredible collaboration that you did with Nordstrom to do your co-branded Atlantic Pacific line, which was huge and amazing and interesting. And I remember showing our team some of the assets where it was like you putting outfits together. I was like, oh, she's marketing this in such a cool way. And, like, we should do something like this for Who What Wear for Target. Like, it was so well executed and I shopped quite a lot of it. So
thank you.
How did that work out? What was the best part of it? What were the biggest learnings? And what lessons did you learn from that process that you still use today with things like Lake, which, by the way, that line sheet is amazing.
Oh, thank you. I feel like the Nordstrom collaboration ended up being such a wonderful fit for so many different reasons. Like I said, when I approach any type of collaboration or partnership, I'm really looking for companies that I feel as though share a lot of the same values. Like I said, coming from a place of empathy, collaboration, kindness, people who really want everybody to succeed and, like, really work together. And the Nordstrom team is wonderful. And the team that I was specifically paired with, because clearly they're a large company, I worked with three specific designers, a product manager, and then higher up on, like, the executive team. And they were all just so excited to work on the line that it made me even more excited, which is, like, the most you can ask for when you're doing something like this, is people who are just so thrilled to be doing it. And initially, the line was supposed to be much smaller. So we ended up doing fall 2018. And because of its success, we did 6 more drops. But the first one, I think we were targeting something around, like, 40 to 50 SKUs. But I think because of my background and because I was really decisive about what I wanted to create, we were just able to get so much done. And everybody really reacted to the product positively internally that they were like, yeah, let's just really blow this out. So it became much, much bigger, which was awesome. But marketing it and whatnot, like, you know, it's a beast. So it was definitely time consuming, but there was such a large team at Nordstrom behind it, like really supporting me, which was wonderful. Like, especially with like those marketing assets, those are the brainchild of Nordstrom's amazing, amazing marketing team. So I feel as though the collaboration came together and was just so fun that I was excited that they wanted to work together again. But I do think, like, looking back towards the end of it, I was so burnt out that I was like, I really need to be careful going forward about like what these look like, which is why I took like a very large break between that launch and then like the next collaboration launch with Lily. So it was just a lot, but wonderful, just a lot.
So talk to me about what you're doing with Lake, because as I just mentioned, I have had the good fortune of seeing it and I just love it. It feels like you. So tell me about that collaboration, what you're excited about, and what we can expect.
Yes. The Lake team has been amazing. So when they approached me, I was so excited about this opportunity. I really love that they have like this incredibly loyal customer base who is fanatical about their product because it is such wonderful, wonderful product. And I feel like they've had so much growth and so much exposure, but I feel like their journey is just beginning. And so I'm excited, obviously, to collaborate with them. And I think they really were looking for somebody to come in and add a lot of color and a lot of spunk. And like, that's really what we did. And I think that it's something a little bit more unexpected for them, but still completely on brand. In every collaboration, you're kind of looking for that Venn diagram of like, where is it me, but where is it also you? And obviously, like, they love stripes, which is such a perfect foray into like my brand and like what I do. And I think I was really excited about some of like the newer pieces and silhouettes that we're doing where, yes, they can be worn around the house or pajamas, but it's that idea that like they can also be styled outside the house. And we're also doing a new fabrication, Terry, which I think is so cool and like so on trend for right now and is such a modern yet retro feel. So there's just so many pieces I'm excited about in the collection.
Same. So now that you have been in this role and focused on your own entrepreneurial journey for a number of years, where are the areas where you feel like you've grown the most? Where are you interested in continuing to evolve? And how do you think about the future?
Yeah. And I feel like you're asking this question at a very good time, because I do feel like this past year, there has been more shakeup in the industry than there has been in like a really long time between like the rise of video and that becoming so important. And I also feel like this idea that before trends and influencers, there were like mega trends and mega influencers. And now there's a lot more focus on community. And it's a lot more of like fragmented, small niches. And I think for me, I feel like I've evolved the most, probably in terms of like fine tuning my style, my photography, like what I'm focused on. And I think that comes with time and experience, but it also comes with age, right? Like, you experiment more when you're in your 20s and you like probably wear a couple questionable things. But I think like, obviously, as you get older, you're just much more confident in your decisions as to like who you are and who you want to be. And it's that fine tuning that's happened that I feel like is the biggest evolution for me. Because if you really think about it, I've stuck to a pretty clear strategy of really only sharing fashion and style. Mm-hmm. And I think when I look forward, this might sound funny, but I think 10 years ago, if somebody was like, what do you want it to look like in 10 years? Like, I never would have guessed that this is where the industry would have evolved to. And so I always try to have a plan, but at the same time, recognize that I want to be in the place in 10 years that we like didn't even know it existed. And I'm really trying to stay focused, but nimble. And I think that the hardest transition for me over the past 2 years has been, how much do I want to embrace video? How much do I really want to change even like the social footprint of what I'm doing? And I've tried to do that in small calculated ways, but it's definitely a time in the industry where there's a lot of change going on. And I'm excited to see where it goes. But for me, I'm like really focusing on a few of these big projects I have on the horizon, like obviously Lake. And I think from there, I'm going to take a pause probably at the end of the summer and really like look back and say like, where do I want to go next?
Good time for evaluation.
Yes.
So one of the things we talk about on this podcast a lot is how the skills that we learn in our first lives have all of these direct applications to our second lives, even if we don't realize it at the time. I think you've done a really great job of illustrating that. But if you were to look back and say, wow, like this is something that I learned back in like the old Navy days or even early Tory days that I still use today, what would that be?
I guess I would say it's that idea that I need to multitask, wear a lot of hats, and like really make sure that I am equally paying attention to like the art and the science of my business. And I do think that there are so many things about like the fast-paced environment and the ability to do both the wonderful things that I love to do, like aesthetically putting outfits together, but then also do invoice roll-ups and look at TYLY numbers and comps and like social activations and things of that nature.
So we also like to talk about mistakes because everyone makes them and folks don't like to talk about it. We just give sort of the highlight reel. So I'm hoping that you can tell me about a mistake that you've made at any point in your career and what you've learned from it.
I would say that both actually in merchandising as well as my influencing career, you like have to trust your gut. And there have been a handful of times where I have had something in the back of my mind where I'm like, this just doesn't seem like the right fit to move forward with. And it's when I like haven't listened to that voice that I've ended up in a place where I have been in a partnership or working with a brand that it then becomes something that is very, very difficult to be involved in. And I would say like, luckily, like 95% of my experiences have been like positive. But I think when I look back and I look at the places that I ended up where I was like, how did I get here? This isn't a great fit. Like, I don't feel heard. It was mostly because I like didn't listen to that first gut instinct that I had.
And I often think that that goes back to we as women are told like you have to be rational and that's just a feeling and feelings aren't facts. Yeah. But yeah, your gut's telling you something and
yes,
you can ignore it, but you're going to have to deal with the repercussions.
Yeah.
So lots of the folks who listen to this podcast are in their first lives and maybe they want to make a huge change. Maybe they want to make a smaller pivot and stay within the same industry, but they know they want to make some sort of change and they just haven't quite done it yet. As someone who has very successfully navigated this road, what advice would you give someone who's sort of standing on the precipice of making a big decision, but just hasn't decided to go for it quite yet?
Yeah. So I guess I would say two things. One, I am extremely risk averse. So I think that, you know, part of my whole journey was to obviously grow both my merchandising as well as my influencing career at the same time. But I'd be lying if I didn't say there was like a part of me that also felt scared to make the leap. And I think for me, it was about getting to a place that I felt comfortable that the risks were not so great that I would have regrets. And that's not for everybody, right? There's some people who are just incredibly optimistic, wonderful risk takers who are like, you know what? I'm going to jump and it's all going to work out. I am not one of those people. So I always say like, can you stair step? Is there any way that you can try this 10% or like get your foot in the door one way just to get a little bit of insight into like what this would look like if this is really, really like what you want to do? But another thing that's like very interesting that I think has come up with some people in my life looking to make a change, I do think that we're talking a lot about obviously careers here, and your career can only fill like so many holes in your life. And I think that we spend a lot of time at work and it's important obviously to find a career that you love. But at the same time, I think if you put too much pressure on your career to be everything, it's just not going to work out. And especially coming from a career where it is very creative, both merchandising obviously is influencing, I still have to find creative outlets outside of my job because that's my job. And so I still need to find hobbies to feel creative because sometimes I don't always feel creative within the confines of what I do at work.
And it's true about all areas. Like you can't focus just on a relationship and expect that to make you happy. You can't focus just on work and expect that to fill every need. Having those outside interests are critical for happiness, period, in all areas of your life. So my last question, also my favorite question, if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self and give younger Blair a little advice,
What would you say?
I would say in my career, I have been very decisive and very like action oriented, which is good. But one thing I was very, very bad at and I'm still working on is when I do fail, I will continue to move forward, but I will revisit that failure again and again and again and try to find where it went wrong. What did I do to contribute to this failure? What could I have done differently? Was there a point in time when if I changed one thing, this wouldn't have happened or it would have worked out differently? And I'm recognizing that there is a healthy amount of self-reflection and you always need to own your side of the street when there is a failure. But at the same time, there's a point where you like you just need to move on and it didn't work out and like everything's going to be fine. But I think that I really, really dwelled on my failures and still do sometimes. And every moment you're doing that, you could be spending on obviously like looking towards the future.
That is a remarkably wonderful answer and one that resonates with me in such intense ways. And it's a control thing, right? So it's like,
oh, yeah.
If I can understand what went wrong, then I can protect myself against it ever happening again. And I mean, that's a sure way to make yourself crazy.
Yeah. And especially in like a lot of instances where, you know, you aren't an island and you're working with probably lots of other people and sometimes it's just a collective failure and like maybe you could have done one or two things differently, but at the end of the day, like that's how it was going to go from the get-go for a million different reasons. And that's why I say like you still have to own your side of the street. It's not like every failure you can just say like, ah, but I think for me, it was like just this unhealthy, like to your point, this control of like, how do I pick apart every single decision that I made in order to figure out how I can be perfect going forward? And there is no perfect.
There is no perfect. Except for this interview, because this, Blair, was phenomenal. I have wanted to do this for so long. Thank you so much for your time and your candor and your incredibly thoughtful answers. This was just a dream.
Oh, this is amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
That was the founder of Atlantic Pacific, Blair Eady. For more inspiring interviews with women like Blair, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you're interested in hearing from on the show. So send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life. Thank you to Lake Pajamas for sponsoring today's episode. There's no better feeling than putting on a pair of pajamas at the end of the day, and Lake designs the softest pajamas imaginable. You'll reach for them every night. Lake creates silhouettes and fabrics for every sleep and lounge preference from their signature 100% Peruvian Pima cotton pajama sets to their buttery soft dream knit to crisp and breathable cotton poplin. In Lake's newest collaboration, they partnered with fellow female founder Blair Eady of Atlantic Pacific to create vivid pieces brimming with confidence and femininity. Launching March 22nd, this limited edition collaboration is a rainbow of sun-soaked sleepwear in their signature Pima, plus ready-to-wear dresses and select styles that double as a cover-up, packing in a poolside punch. Take it from Blair Eady, great personal style never sleeps. Text Second Life to 21426 to subscribe to Lake's texts and to be able to shop the collab a day early on March 21st. Again, that's Second Life to number 21426. Plus, receive 10% off towards your Atlantic Pacific for Lake purchase with the code SECONDLIFE.